Hey, Heather here. Designed to empower individuals to be their best self, the Ron Kitchens Always Forward Leadership Podcast brings fresh understanding to the issues today's leaders are facing and equips them with new perspectives and resources to lead forward. Welcome to today's conversation with Ron Kitchens and Brad Lominick.
Thank you for joining us for the Always Forward Leadership Podcast. I'm Ron Kitchens, and joining me as always is my chief apologist, Brad Lominick.
I don't know
what that means.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Mostly has to say I'm sorry for
Please
me.
Forgive me. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
That was my bad. My fault. I'm trying to think of all the ways that I can
say I'm sorry. But how do you say it authentically? Because in your leadership, you've led literally hundreds of people, and you've led from cowboys who I assume some didn't have educations at levels of yours to John Maxwell, PhD on his team. And you were leading at that level, and you've led hundreds and thousands of people. How do you say you're sorry?
Well, whatever words you're using, it's all about the posture in which you're saying it and the attitude and the sense of what's coming from the inside. That's what I've found. So whether I say I'm sorry or my fault or my bad or I shouldn't have done that, forgive me. I mean, any of the phrases that we use to approach somebody and have that, in many ways, I guess you could call it this moment where you're clarifying that you were at fault. The words many times don't mean as much as the attitude with which you bring the words and the posture as a leader with which you bring what you're saying. And people can tell. You know, remember the Seinfeld episode where George was asking for the apology from his friend who had gone through Alcoholics Anonymous? And it was like step 10, where you're supposed to go back and you're supposed to ask forgiveness or apologize to anybody you've wronged. And George kept saying, no, I need you to say, I'm sorry. And finally, the guy just like blew up. For all of my Seinfeld, raise your hand if you're a Seinfeld enthusiast out there, all of you Seinfeld people. You know what I'm talking about. But it's not the words. Like, that's what I would say. But Ron, the reality is we have an expert.
We do.
An apologist expert.
Yeah. Who knew such a thing?
Who knew there was
exists?
Such a thing? Yeah.
But, you know, when we see in days in corporate communication, so, you know, we saw a famous airline's staff.
Yes. Do it incorrectly.
Do it incorrectly.
Could
taking
argue.
Somebody off of an airplane and the CEO coming out and not correctly apologizing. You know, when we looked at the explosion and pollution of the Gulf and, you know, the CEO coming out and saying that he couldn't really deal with it. He was sailing that week, but he was
bad
sorry.
Example.
Yeah. So we know there are ways to do it bad. You know, my high school football coach, Paul Skeens, who's a great leadership, first leadership book I was ever given, Coach Skeens gave me, by Grant Taff. You remember him? He was head coach
Baylor.
At Baylor. And it was this great leadership book. And Coach Skeens, I was captain, and I said something that wasn't in the best interest of a player. And I apologized, and he pulled me aside and said, now I want you to do that again. And remember, you apologize with your eyes.
Hmm.
And that was a lesson I will never forget, is you have to look people in the eye.
Yep.
And you can read an apology in somebody's eye, whether it's real or not. But like I said, we have an expert on it, and I want you to hear my interview with Keith Harrett, who's an associate dean at Western Michigan University, a place that I'm proud to be a member of the Board of Trustees of. So let's listen to the interview with Keith. Hey, thank you for joining us for the Always Forward Leadership Podcast. I'm Ron Kitchens, and I'm so excited to be with Keith Harrett today. And so this is one of those things that we all know there's amazing people in our own backyards, but sometimes we forget to look for that. And I'm reading online this great article about apologizing, which unfortunately is something we all have to do every now and then. And I realize I know the guy who wrote the article, and he's in my own backyard. So Keith, thanks for being here.
Great. It's my pleasure.
So why don't you, rather than me tell the listeners about you, you tell the listeners about you.
Sure. I'm a professor of communication at Western Michigan University, as well as have held a number of administrative posts.
Go Broncos. Over the last 3 years. So as a trustee of the university, I'm very proud to be a Bronco.
Yeah, I joke that my interest in apologies is rooted in the fact that I was raised a Baptist. And I always got in trouble with my mom. So, you know, confession was always part and parcel.
Mount Zion Southern Baptist Church.
Absolutely.
Where I found God.
Yeah, but I can still remember I was in college. And many of your listeners may remember Lee Iacocca.
Absolutely.
Who was, you know, first with Ford Motor Company and then basically rescued Chrysler Corporation from bankruptcy. And they had an incident, I think at 88 or 89, in which the company would have cars come off the assembly line with their odometers unhooked. And so they would do a couple miles of testing, hook up the odometer, and then sell the car as brand new. Well, as you can imagine, over time that evolved, and there were some significant abuses. And, you know, the scandal broke after a period of time when some executives were out on the highway and they got caught speeding. And their defense to the police officer was, hey, the odometer's unhooked. I didn't know how fast I was going. And so, of course, you know, the newspapers discovered that.
It's never the crime. It's always the cover-up.
Exactly. And so, you know, Lee Iacocca already had a great reputation as a communicator, but he was very clear. He was forthright. He promised to fix it, you know, fix the cars that were in any way, shape, or form damaged. Gave people credits, you know, and so I thought, wow, that's really interesting. And man, he nailed it. He handled that so, so very well. And so, you know, that was kind of the germ of the interest for me in terms of following a little bit deeper into this topic.
And I remember that incident. I remember it with that clarity, but I remember the incident. And how important is it today in a world that's much more transparent? So, and if you weren't a car guy or you didn't have a Chrysler, you probably don't really remember that thing. But in today, where, you know, the president's tweeting 10, 12, 14 tweets a day,
right.
The world of internet communications is instantaneous, not always correct, but instantaneous. How important is it for a point leader, whether it's the CEO or president or lead pastor, how important is it for them to be a great communicator and understand what they're apologizing for?
Oh, you know, it is just essential in that, as I alluded to, on one level, it's a basic human interaction. You know, we do things to our family, our friends, our loved ones, strangers that cause offense. And, you know, if you think about how many times a day we just naturally say, oh, excuse me, or oh, sorry about that, it's almost a form of social lubrication, right? It helps us negotiate our days and our times and our relationships with one another. But certainly as social media has just exploded, it's just taken on a whole nother level of dimension. You know, it was interesting to watch the research over the last 10 years. First, it was a traditional kind of apologies that you were referencing. They would typically be done through the newspaper or people would hear about it on the evening news. So you did get a fair amount of currency because people watched news back then, right? And then, you know, a few years ago, it was like, oh, there's this Twitter and, you know, news groups and somebody should look at that. And now we're to the point where we don't talk about crises or apologies or public apologies without acknowledging first and foremost, they're very much part and parcel of social media and social media function.
So two incidents come for me. There are probably lots more times where I have or should have apologized. You know, one comes that I was flippant in a conversation with an editorial board. I frankly thought I was a better communicator than I was. It wasn't that I was misquoted. It just was out of context how it was presented. And it really offended some folks.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to go on and write an editorial apologizing, I didn't even try to make my point clear. It was just, I'm sorry. Here's what I'm really about. And it was pretty well received and accepted. I think those that were very vocal that they had been offended by my conversation, it was some ageism things,
right,
took it well and accepted that. And the other time happened very recently where I said something that I meant flippantly as a joke, and a member of our team came to me who didn't have power. You know, I clearly had lots more authority and said, hey, I need an apology. You've both hurt my feelings and damaged my reputation with that comment, and I need you to apologize for that, which took huge amounts of courage. I mean, it took amazing amounts of courage for her to do that and say that because it wasn't something that I even perceived. How important is it as a leader, as someone who has authority, to put yourself in a position where people can raise the bull flag on you and say, hey, let me give you a mulligan on the behavior, but you still have to own the behavior.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And if you look at some of the organizational behavior research, organizations really struggle with people who challenge authority, right? On a good day, we call them boat rockers. They're somebody who just raises some questions and like, you're really? On a bad day, you know, organizations pejoratively see them as whistleblowers. And, you know, the data on whistleblowers is they really work hard to go through traditional channels and they're still not heard. And it's only, you know, when they continue to be unsuccessful, do they tend to go in a more vocal or public context. So I think it's one of those things institutionally we all struggle with regards to creating a culture and an atmosphere in which people feel comfortable coming to you, making a little bit of a challenge, you know, acknowledging that power differential and saying, you know, this bothered me or, you know, this offended me. And, you know, I think one of the biggest dimensions is it's just so against the grain of how we're taught to, you know, see ourselves and behave. You know, what is a great leader? Goal-oriented, purposeful, energetic, you know, all of those things that connote action. Certainly we talk about being a good listener and being reflective, but those are almost sometimes, you know, oh, well, those are the soft skills.
Nobody talks about that at the eulogy.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it is a real masterful trick to know when to apologize and how to apologize when you're enacting the role of a leader. Because, you know, conversely, you don't want to be somebody who apologizes all the time because, you know, then there could emerge a perception of weakness or a lack of confidence or surety. But yeah, it's a very, very fine line that, you know, institutional leaders have to walk. And I think be careful to craft an environment that's successful. I think you put your, you know, finger on both the two major challenges that happen interpersonally for leaders. One is context. In your example, and when I think of when I've gotten in trouble, what it comes down to is they don't know me. They don't know the full sense of my background and where I'm from and where that comment is coming from. And then second, we love a good joke. We love humor, but we always have to be cognizant of the fact that humor doesn't work for everybody. You know, the whole idea of a joke is that there's an inside who gets it and there's outsiders who don't. And so, yeah, that's one of the toughest things where, you know, great leaders, of course, can use humor very effectively, but it's not without risk.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. How important is it for a point leader, a CEO, a lead minister, city manager, whatever your title is, how important is it for you to own a problem at the company level that you weren't aware of? And the two things that come to mind right now are we've seen a number of airline problems recently where behaviors took place on airplanes with employees. We saw a journalist get bumped from a seat she paid $30 more for and raise all kinds of abuse of the airline and the other passengers. I think there was apologies due both ways there. And then I'm also thinking of the Deepwater Horizon, where the CEO of BP, and I don't even remember the context of it. All I remember is saying he couldn't deal with it because he was going sailing and couldn't talk about that. And so I will never think of that company without seeing him on a luxury sail yacht.
He also said, oh, I want my life back. You know, do you think the last month has been fun for me? I want my life back. And of course, you know, he walked into those families who had tragically lost loved ones in the explosion. And they were like, well, you know, I want my husband back, you know, kind of thing.
So how does the CEO take ownership authentically of those things? And what roles should they have? I mean, I think it's one of those really tricky things that, you know, I didn't do it. You know, I don't even know the people who did it, but it's my name on their paycheck. So how do you deal with that?
I think you really raise an interesting question in terms of a CEO and an institutional leader. You know, one of the first things we say is you should be communicating regularly and frequently before the crisis hits. And, you know, to the degree that people know you, so that if you say something that's not just perfect, they give you the benefit of the doubt because, you know, you've been in their homes or you've been in their schools or their neighborhoods or in public contexts in which they can, you know, give you the benefit of the doubt. And so, you know, the first thing that I would say is having a record in which you're regularly meeting with people and talking to them, you know, really helps so that when things don't quite go, you know, nearly as well, that, you know, you're in pretty good shape. The second thing, you know, that I think you also alluded to there was the notion of authenticity, right? What I've discovered is, you know, there are a lot of two-page articles and websites, you know, four things to say in a crisis, top 10 crisis mistakes, right? And, you know,
that's my blog next month. So I hope this is good because we've already published.
You'll do well, I'm sure. But my point is that some people look at this kind of context and an apology as sort of just a calculus, right? Or a recipe. Well, it's two parts flour, one part sugar, water, eggs, mix well. Voila, you have an apology. And I think those who demonstrate that I'm checking the boxes, that I'm supposed to say this, and I'm supposed to say this. You know, so much of what worked for Lee Iacocca back in the late 80s was people could look him in the eye. You know, they could measure how he, you know, communicated, how he listened, how he confronted matters and issues. And so, you know, part of that is, I think, authenticity. And for some CEOs, they can exude that whether they have it or not. And, you know, others are challenged with that, you know, from the get-go. The second thing that I would say is also paying attention to nonverbals, right? It's really easy for verbal messages and nonverbal messages to conflict. And what the research shows is that if there's any disagreement between what you're saying and what people are seeing, they'll trust what they're seeing. And so, you know, you can undercut a good message, a well-crafted apology, by, you know, giving an offhanded comment before it starts, or, you know, joking with somebody before you take the stage, or, for lack of a better way to say it, reading it in such a way that doesn't have inflection and, you know, concern and compassion in your voice. So those are, you know, a couple things that I think leaders, you know, need to get and get right, you know, right out of the box with regards to an apology. The other really, really important thing that I think is a little bit underdeveloped in the apology literature is the notion of time. And what we tend to say is that time is structural rather than chronological, okay? And what I mean by that is if you offend me and then you go, oops, sorry, right? The notion there is that you haven't had time for moral reflection to occur. And so if you apologize too soon, you know, there's a perception that, you know, you're just trying to get out of it, move on, you know, check that box, and you haven't really come to grips with, you know, what it is you might have said or done. And conversely, and this is the example we know much more in terms of, you know, contemporary examples, more often than not, though, people don't apologize too early, they wait too long. And, you know, you can argue that, you know, a quick enough apology is such that it can keep it from the situation or the context or the crisis from getting even worse. And so, you know, that's where we say, you know, part of good leadership is really being able to study, manage, and adapt to a situation. And part of that is knowing when is it appropriate to apologize. Because if you think about it, if the other shoe is going to drop tomorrow, do you want to go public tonight with your apology, right? Because then new information just happened, and you're going to be in a situation where you have to apologize a second time. And, you know, that's kind of the other thing that the literature is pretty clear on. The more apologies you offer, the worse it gets. The best apology, you wait till the criticisms, the complaints, the judgments have kind of, you know, fully formed. Make one apology, then, you know, you put the matter to rest. And again, you can only make that work, of course, if there's not a new revelation, you know, the next day or the next day or the next day.
So I wish I knew how to say that in Russian.
I was about to make that comment myself. So, yes.
You know, because I was going to go a different way on that. So that's interesting. When Chase had a problem with, it's referred to as the London whale.
Yes.
And, a guy lost, I don't know, $1 billion in value or some ridiculous number.
I think seven.
Seven. Yeah. Jamie Dimon, who I've come to know a little bit, not well, he wouldn't say, hey, Ronnie Ray, when we rocked into the room. But after that, he really traveled the country. He got his executive leadership team, and I think they were in buses. I know they were in matching shirts that were Lands' End shirts, which, what's Lands' End's logo? A whale. And so, and that was pointed, and right. They toured the country, meeting with groups, talking about their solidity as a bank, you know, how they'd had safeguards in, how this problem happened. And I tell you, my respect for him went up dramatically. And I don't know if it was because they were riding the bus or because they had whale shirts on, but
yeah.
There was true sincerity, humor, and some, hey, this one got away from us.
Yeah, the thing I like about the example you just gave is, you know, we tend to think of apologies or, you know, that kind of crisis management within a vacuum. And again, the context there was, you know, the Great Recession had just occurred. And so, you know, there was certainly a sense of, was the bank taking risks with, in effect, public money? Because through TARP, everything's guaranteed anyways, you know, no big deal. And so I think they really got public scrutiny that they wouldn't have gotten in a normal or traditional context. Again, I think, you know, Jamie Dimon and his way he's known to be, you know, forthright, confident, and an excellent communicator really helped in that situation. But, you know, I've also dug a little deeper on that. And he was also very astute in terms of, you know, marshaling board support and his staff in terms of removing, you know, some of the people who are directly involved, which is something we really look for or we find happens institutionally in crises. And, you know, I think the idea there is, you know, there is some wrong and we need to sort of like a surgeon cut it out. And then, you know, the institution as a whole can go on and succeed. But yeah, I would give Dimon high marks overall for how he handled that crisis because the outcome was not guaranteed.
No, absolutely it wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, he was brought before Congress. So yeah, he navigated it well.
Yeah, and he was a guy who had been criticizing Congress. So there's some mea culpas that have to take place there. So as we're speaking to, you know, the vast majority of our listeners are leaders. They're people who are either leading in their own lives, leading in the classroom, leading at big organizations, or wannabe, or emerging leaders. What are the pre-lessons? Let's assume everybody's going to have a crisis at some point, whether it's a failure of an institution, it's a failure of their own making. How do you prepare as a leader to make that authentic apology? Are there muscles you can flex? Are there behaviors you can have in advance that make it more authentic?
Yeah, there's a lot of people who talk about the importance of having a crisis management plan. You know, I think that's a little bit overblown. Having said that, the virtue of a plan is you get people within the institution talking before something hits. And so, you know, typically in a crisis, people who don't normally work together are working together. And so I think that's a real positive. The second, you know, dynamic that occurs is there's always a fight between your communication staff and your legal staff. You know, legal is don't admit guilt. Don't say we're responsible or we're going to get sued, right? You know, I want to be nuanced in how I say this, but there is significant good evidence that says, you know, the right apology delivered the right way will actually lessen the likelihood that you're going to get sued.
Deflates the balloon.
Exactly. Now, having said that, there's numerous examples of individuals who are just waiting for, you know, a pharmaceutical CEO to say, yes, we're guilty or we're responsible. And then, you know, boom, lawsuit certainly occurs. And so, you know, I think those are a couple of those things. To take it more, though, as the question referenced, you know, to the CEO or leader, I think one of the biggest pieces that, you know, an individual like that has to grapple with is they're not naturally inclined to deliver an apology. When a major crisis happens, it gets more coverage largely because somebody screwed up. And it was, you know, the chief executive or the chief communications person who screwed up in a public context. And, you know, researchers get together and say, how in the world could they say that? You know, how stupid was that? And when you start to think of yourself in that context and in that situation, you know, A, everything is moving underneath you. And so, you know, it's hard to, you know, really have a good sense of what the right move, the right thing to say, you know, those kinds of things are part and parcel. But again, more often than not, these are individuals who, given their very nature, are not people who are inclined to apologize in their day-to-day life. And so, you know, for me, part of that is to practice that in smaller contexts when there might be something that didn't quite go so well. And, you know, you don't have to go, we're profoundly sorry, we screwed up, here's what we're doing to make, you know, you don't have to go into that level of detail, but that was a genuine learning experience for us, right? You know, and people are sophisticated enough that, you know, if you're not a huge communicator and you don't say a ton of things, but you say, you know, that was a real learning experience, they can hear an apology there. They can hear humility there. They can hear, I've learned my lesson from there.
So there's no formula. There's no magic formula that you've got to hit these 3 points in your apology to be authentic.
There is, but there isn't. A good apology certainly states I screwed up, right?
And is it specific about what you screwed up about?
It depends.
So yeah. I screwed up, honey. Yeah. I'm sorry you were gone all weekend and I didn't do the dishes.
Yes. You know, naming the offense. The second thing, of course, is the idea of what we call a promise to not do it again. Okay. I've learned my lesson. Not going to happen again. You know, and then you get kind of, okay, I'll forgive you this one time. And then third, what we oftentimes see is some kind of corrective action. And in fact, you know, why don't we go to, you know, couples therapy in their interpersonal relationship, you know, kind of context. Now, having said that, you can frame all of those things in dramatically different ways. And again, it goes back to, does it come across as authentic? You know, there's a big argument in the literature in which, you know, companies especially don't say, we've screwed up, we take full responsibility, but they issue what we call a state of regret. You know, what happened was tragic, right? And again, people are sophisticated listeners enough to know they're saying, yeah, we did it. We own it. And so, you know, to me, it's those ideas of acknowledging guilt, accepting responsibility, but they can happen in any number of ways. There's some evidence of late that with some companies who are especially worried about liability, they don't take responsibility during their apology, but they announce they're going to pay people, you know, some kind of compensatory amount.
Random acts of gifts.
Right. And so again, people recognize it's a complex, turbulent, legal, social, political environment. And so they're doing the right thing.
So is there a difference between genders in apologizing? Are one gender more likely to apologize? Listeners of this know I'm a huge fan of millennials. I just think potentially they're the greatest generation ever. Is there a difference generationally of apologizing?
Oh, wow. I mean, we could do another podcast, I think, just on those questions. You know, again, it's stereotyping, it's generalizations. And as my stats teacher taught me long ago, all generalizations are ultimately false. But yeah, I do think women tend to be a little bit more comfortable going there with regards to apologies. Though I think once you get into leadership, you know, there's a fair amount of evidence that suggests from a leadership perspective, a highly feminine approach doesn't play well with a traditional company.
Traditional hierarchy.
Yeah, traditional hierarchy. And so I think in those situations, women, you know, executives still have to enact kind of a masculine, you know, kind of leadership style. But yeah, that's a great question that I think, you know, could really take some unpacking. Millennials, that one to me is interesting. You know, I'm thinking of it in terms of my children. And I find, you know, some of them are very open and willing, and others are kids a few words and I don't get much. So, yeah.
Well, I have a 22-year-old daughter who I spend a lot of time apologizing for how dumb I am.
You know,
so, you know, maybe it's...
You know, you do have an excellent point because, you know, I can remember, you know, being a young person and the judgment and criticism I held toward my parents that, you know, aren't you going to get that right? And, you know, I can see my kids doing the same. So good comment.
Well, Keith, I want to thank you for joining us. This is just fascinating to me. And leaders out there, a lot of us were never given the leadership tools we needed to advance our careers. And so topics like this on apologizing are critical for our growth. So we come to you with the Always Forward Leadership Podcast to help bring those things into your life. If you have ideas of other topics we should address, I'd love to hear from you at Ron Kitchens on Twitter. And we want to thank you today and always for joining us for the Always Forward Leadership Podcast. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for joining us for the Always Forward Leadership Podcast. We hope today's insights will help you develop into the leader you dream to be. To subscribe to Ron's blog or to submit a question for Ron to discuss in a future podcast, visit ronkitchens.com or tweet him at ronkitchens.